It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, this is Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. It is our first official episode back. We had a few weeks ago the Dave Branstetter returning episode with Paul Oliver, and that was a special edition episode. But as of this episode with my guest Marshall Thornton, we are officially back doing two episodes, not one, two episodes every week. So as I said, my guest today is Marshall Thornton, who has won 3 Lambda Literary Awards for Best Gay Mystery. He was most known for the Boys Town series, but I'd say at this point, there are probably some people that aren't even aware of the Boys Town series and know him for his Pink's video series and his Wyandotte County mysteries. And I'll say this, that when he announced that the Boys Town series was going to end, people were distraught. And I think he made it okay. Welcome to the show, Marshall.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
Would you agree with what I just said?
That people prefer the Pink's video?
Not that they prefer it, but did they get over the distraught over Boys Town quicker than they thought they would?
Some people have. I'm still trying not to give that secret away. But you know, I guess it's maybe time. You know, I have started another series that does reference the Boys Town books quite a lot. Let's put it that way. So if you love that series, you know, you can.
So this is an exclusive.
I haven't really talked about it before. No, I mean, obviously people have figured it out. Year of the Rat, which came out last year, is a new series with a character named Dom Riley. But it has really very, very strong connections to the Boys Town books and Nick Nowak. So, and I'm actually writing the second one today.
Actually, I think as you were writing that, you told me that one time. Now I recall that you mentioned it.
I might have. It's something I haven't actually talked about in any kind of, you know, public way before. But that, I mean, it's been an interesting experience to keep it going in a different way.
I need to ask you this. Are you a plotter or a pantser? There's a reason I'm asking. Do you want to know the reason I'm asking?
Why are you asking?
Back 2 years ago, before I even decided I was going to do a podcast, I told you I was thinking about doing one. And you said, please, please don't ask the authors, are they a plotter or a pantser? Nobody gives a damn. And I got to tell you, that was the best advice you could give me. Not just because of that question, you made me realize that this show is for readers, not writers. Mm-hmm. So even though I do get into writing techniques because it's a part of a writer's life, right, it's not the focus of the show.
Right.
So, and you put that in the right perspective for me. So I thank you for that very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Since I asked the question, why don't you tell people what the difference is between a plotter and a pantser?
Oh, well, certainly, you know, and some people write with outlines and some people just start writing. And my personal experience and what I would recommend to anybody is, you know, you have, every book is different and they write themselves in different ways. And certainly, you know, you're at different points in your writing career. And so, you know, it may work one way when you've written 10 books and it may work an entirely different way when you've written 20. It all depends. And, you know, both have their advantage. I don't think I've ever outlined something or plotted something completely full out, because that then becomes a project in itself. And, you know, I mean, certainly if you're like in the film industry, you have to learn how to write an outline and you have to learn how to write one that people will respond to because people read them. But, you know, when you're just doing it for yourself in order to get the work done, you know, you really just need to do what's necessary. And whatever works for you.
What I'm curious about is, folks out there, you can email me about this, is, are you interested in the writing, the craft, if you're a reader? The reason I ask is, I know that J.K. Rowling is a plotter. And I know that Stephen King is a pantser. And I only know that because I read it. But really, I don't care. I would talk to you maybe about it, because as writers, you know, I may be saying, what do you do? How much do you plot? But it's more trade talk. Beyond that, what other people do, it's not interesting. So I don't know. If we're both wrong, leave a message or voicemail or send a message and say, you know what, Brad and Marshall are wrong.
I do think what you just said is interesting about J.K. Rowling, because I have been asked, you know, if I plot my series all the way through. And I never have at all. I didn't, you know, I had no idea how many Boys Town books I would write when I wrote the first one. I didn't even know if I would write a second mm-hmm. one. And I've never done that with any series. I typically get an idea for the next book while writing whichever one I'm working on. And I may have several books in mind. But I mean, at the moment, you know, I have no idea how long I'm going to write the Pink's books. You just kind of get a feeling, you know, with Boys Town, I kind of felt like I think I've done as much as I can in Chicago, and it was time to move on to something else, slightly different. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to do that, because if I write one book a year in a series, you know, I don't want to plot out 10 books, because by the time I get to number 9, I'm going to start to get bored.
Well, I hope you continue the Pink's video series. I enjoyed Boys Town. I really enjoyed reading the Wyandotte County mystery, which we're going to talk about today. But Pink's video, Noah, I so connect with Noah and his friends. I know all of them personally. That, you know, hanging out in Silver Lake with this crowd is... I so connect with it. So that's why I enjoy the Pink's video series. So for my sake, please continue for at least a little while.
Okay, Brad, just for you.
Thank you. So I want to talk about this. So you announced that Boys Town was ending. Mm-hmm. The final one came out in 2020. At that time, you were doing the Pink's video series. And the last one of those stopped in 2020. And I'm like, what's up here? And then you started... the book, The Less Than Spectacular Times of Henry Milch, which was the first Wyandotte County book, that came out in 2020. Then you did The Year of the Rat. So what you're saying now is, I'm going to write another Pink's video. So we have a Pink's video series. We have the Wyandotte County series. We have the Dom Reilly mysteries. You were really focused for years on one series. And now you have, what is that, three or four at one time?
I've got three going.
How much of a challenge is it?
It's not much of a challenge. I mean, I certainly this year I realized, okay, I'm only going to write mysteries. And so, you know, I have an idea for something else I'd like to write, and I might be able to squeeze it in. But it's only going to be difficult if I get a really strong feeling for something else I want to write that's out of that genre. Also in there was Father of the Brides last summer. So that's part of why the others have taken a little bit longer. But typically, you know, I really want to get back to a particular series. I really wanted to get back to the Dom Reilly series, and I'm really happy to be in there I'm about a quarter of the way through the book, and that's really kind of fun.
Well, the reason I asked if it's challenging is because the tone and the feel of each of the books is very different. And I'm impressed when somebody can do that so well.
Thank you. It's actually not that difficult for me. I mean, they're, you know, since I write first person, since I write in character, it's just a matter of like being with that character. So it's a larger extension of what you do in a scene with four people, you know, where you try to capture the voice of each character.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I read an article you wrote a few years ago in a screenwriter's magazine about where writers are taught to write what you know, which I always said was stupid advice, because if you only write what you know, you're only going to be able to write two or three books and you'll be done. But actually, that's not necessarily true, because there's a little of you in every one of your books.
Absolutely.
You've lived in Chicago with Boys Town. You've lived in Silver Lake with Pink's Video. Wyandotte County. You have that in Michigan, which is where you're currently living. Mm-hmm. And I've also heard you say that you've described apartments and such that you've lived in.
Yep.
So in a sense, you are writing what you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I understand when you say that you don't feel like there's many books if you're just going to stick to yourself. And there was a time in my life where I was like, oh, what? Write what you know. Well, I don't know anything. But I began to realize that I do know a lot. And it's easy to put myself in situations that are partially similar. I mean, I certainly never solved a murder. That part of it
right.
is not writing what I know. I guess, you know, I have this really great writers group that we've now been meeting now again for 2 years. We met a lot when I was at UCLA. And, you know, we reconnected during the pandemic. And they're all a little younger than I am. But I'm realizing more and more that you have to always ask yourself, why me? When you write something, because you have to be able to market it and you have to sell it to someone in a studio or you have to sell it as a book. And people really do want to know, why should I read this from you? You know, what gives you the authority to write something and the authenticity? And, you know, I mean, not that everybody cares about these issues, but and it actually even helps you as a writer to know why you think it's important that you talk about something. And certainly, even, you know, as you're talking about my books, I am actually very grateful that I started the Pink's books and set them in Silver Lake, because that neighborhood is essentially gone. There's one gay bar in that neighborhood, from what I understand, and it's no longer a gay neighborhood. And so I'm very happy that I'm capturing little tidbits of that in my books.
There actually may be two. There's the Eagle, which used to be the Gauntlet, which used to be something else. It's been changed its name 4 times. That's still there.
Is it? Okay.
And Akbar really isn't in Silver Lake, but it's kind of at the fringe.
Right.
But actually, you know what? That's very gentrified. They call themselves a gay bar, but I think if you walked in the door, you wouldn't know it. So you're right. There really is only one. And I was in Silver Lake about a decade after you were, during the early 2000s. And it was still very much like you described. And I think I know I've mentioned on the show and maybe to you, when I started writing my series, Mitch, my protagonist, lives in Silver Lake. And I said, you know, I better take a look over there because I live way on the opposite side of LA now. Mm-hmm. And I pulled up on Google Maps and I said, oh shit, I'm going to have to go for a drive because it's a contemporary story. I said, it doesn't look at all like I remember. And sure, I went over there and it's a whole different world.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world. It's very gentrified. It's a nice community, but it's not Silver Lake like I remember or like you remember. It's
right.
Kind of sad. But that's happening everywhere.
It is. It is. And it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, West Hollywood is vanishing. You told me Boys Town is kind of vanishing. Mm-hmm. The Castro is vanishing. The ghettos are going away.
Yes.
For good, for better or for worse. I think there's positive and negative with it.
Yeah, I think the reason they're going away is really sad. You know, people tell you, oh, it's the apps, and I don't believe that for a minute. The reason that these places are disappearing is that young people cannot afford to live in these places. You know, when I was a kid, you know, when I was in Boys Town, I was in my 20s. When I would hang out in Silver Lake, I was in my early 30s. And that's the age of the people who really kept these ghettos, quote, going. But, you know, it's really challenging to be those ages now and live in these places. Or, you know, live anywhere that isn't suburban or you're in your parents' basement.
Yeah. And well, the big joke, and it's not really a joke, is that, you know, the Castro at one time was a pretty, I wouldn't say rundown neighborhood, but it wasn't the nicest of places. And us gays folks moved in and started fixing up the place and can't afford it anymore. And actually, the exodus out of the Castro is for several reasons. One, like you said, it's grossly expensive. And I used to love to go to the Castro every weekend. But a lot of my friends have left San Francisco in general because they just say the city's too many problems. And it's one of the reasons why Palm Springs has exploded as a gay mecca. I don't know when the last time you were in West Hollywood was.
Very long time ago.
But you probably wouldn't recognize it either. Well, first of all, there were still a good number of gay bars before the pandemic. The last count I had since the pandemic hit, and I hate to talk about that, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. The last count I had is 8 bars had closed since the pandemic hit, including the Fault Line, which wasn't really West Hollywood. But anyway, if you go there now, it's very upscale stores, very upscale condominiums, and a lot of homeless camps. There's no in between.
Wow.
Lots and lots of homeless camps.
Yeah.
It had been years before I'd been up there, and I drove up that way. My husband and I drove through it on a way somewhere to just check it out. And I'm like, oh my God, this has changed so much. And been there a few times since then, and it's still the same.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of brought up an interesting point. It's, you know, it's not just that we can't live in these neighborhoods anymore, but it's also that the bars can't afford to stay there. You know, the real estate cost of the actual businesses. You know, I mean, the gay ghettos that I lived in most of my life, it's like, you know, it wasn't just bars. It was little restaurants. It was little shops, you know, little places that catered to the community, you know, and they were businesses that didn't have an enormous margin, you know, and so now they're like, you know, they can't compete with some name brand place that everybody sees, you know. And that's really sad because now everywhere you go in the country, it's just like, it's the same. There's no reason to travel because, you know, it's like the same stores in this town that I have. It's just like weird.
You know, it started with the interstates because every exit had the McDonald's and the same thing. Mm-hmm. And now it's pretty much all cities.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you go to tourist cities, everyone has a Hard Rock Cafe and you know, I can list off all the stores. It's like, why bother anymore? Because it's just going to be the same thing that you saw the last place. I do actually have a theory, and I want to ask you this.
Okay.
Since you're talking about the leases and that sort of thing. Now, you lived in Silver Lake, and I lived in Silver Lake, and we know of Circus of Books. And it's pretty obvious that Circus of Books, for those that haven't been in the area or haven't seen the Netflix special about Circus of Books, it was an adult video store with magazines, and that's primarily what it was the videos, and it was very popular. Now, it's easy to say that the internet killed it. I have no doubt that the internet killed Circus of Books. But I have another theory about stores like White Rabbit Books that used to be in West Hollywood. There was a big one in New York City that, anyway, every major city had the gay bookstore or a few of the big gay bookstores, and they're all gone.
Right.
My theory is, because a lot of people are saying, well, gay people aren't reading anymore, especially gay men aren't reading anymore. My theory is all of those bookstores that had the beautiful displays always still had that magazine rack.
Right.
And there were always a lot of guys at that magazine rack. And my theory is that those stores sold great gay novels or nonfiction gay books, but it was probably those magazines that kept them running. So my thought is maybe it was the internet that killed them too. You think there's anything to that?
Yes and no. I mean, everything that you could get in a gay bookstore was stuff you could not get somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, certainly, you know, if you're talking about porno magazines per se, those barely exist anymore. And I suppose that is an internet-based phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would also say that, you know, major gay fiction has really shifted. There was a moment in the 90s where it was really strong and very specific and very authentic. And now there's not a whole lot of interest in anything like that. You know, what I see on the shelves, and I work in a bookstore, is stuff that's palatable to straight people. You know, from major publishers, it's like they're putting, you know, they want to put out things that straight people want to read about gay people, about queer people. You know, it's like, so there's a lot of books that basically answer questions, you know, and not just in a nonfiction manner. You know, they answer questions in a fictional way, so that, you know, straight people get curious, or they've got relatives, and it's like, oh, we go to the bookstore, and they're like the major part of the market, which is a little odd. And I don't know that I believe gay men don't read, because I get contact from them a lot. You know, I had a guy send me an email this morning. So, you know, men are reading, and men are reading fiction. So I think in a lot of ways, the major publishers have just abandoned our community, and they don't want to publish books for us. They will publish books that appeal tangentially, but not directly.
What was the coming out book that was so popular the past, and they made a movie on it? I don't remember. I was going to go on about how much I hated it.
Are you thinking about Simon?
Yes. I hated it. But it's very much mainstream. It would appeal to both gay and straight audiences. Those that like a schmaltzy story with a schmaltzy ending. That was my opinion on it. At least I haven't read the book, but I did see the movie, and I was like really disappointed at the.
I saw the movie and I read the book. I feel different things about them. You know, the movie, it was kind of like, in a weird way, it was nice to see a gay high school movie taking place in the same non-realistic fantasy high school that every other straight high school movie takes place in?
Yes.
You can get more information about episodes, plus scoops on book releases and promotions by LGBTQ crime authors each and every week. Simply head over to queerwritersofcrime.com and sign up for the newsletter. Brad made it easy and put the link right here in the show notes. Need a little nudge? Click it now and you'll also get a free ebook by one of a select group of outstanding authors. That makes not subscribing just plain silly. It's all yours at queerwritersofcrime.com.
Back to the are gay men reading. You know, young adult novels are selling like crazy, and they're not all selling to straight people, I'm sure, or straight kids. So I'm happy to see that. And the other thing I will say is, one of the reasons I came back to start this podcast is, when I started podcasting, I didn't realize I was going to love it, and I love it. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what really brought me back. What really brought me back was all the emails and Messenger and tweet messages saying, when are you bringing the show back? Because I said it was going on hiatus, but I really didn't know if it was going to be a hiatus. I just said that so I could come back if I wanted to. But there was so much call for it, and I thought that was a good sign. It means people are reading. At least the 5 or 6 people that listen to the show are reading.
I would want to point out one thing about what you just said. Young adult novels are only read by young people about half the time. There's a huge audience for them amongst older people. It's a big genre, you know, not just because kids are reading.
So let's talk about Henry Milch.
Okay.
Last month, you published A Fabulously Unfabulous Summer for Henry Milch. That is the second of the Henry Milch stories. When I told you I hadn't read the first one, you sent me the first one just so I could get a taste of the story rather than the second one and jumping in, which I appreciate. But I will tell you, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
So I look forward to the next one. So I liked Henry. Tell people who Henry is.
The books are set in 2003. Henry is basically a club kid who's been going to the bars in LA, West Hollywood, really enjoying that scene. And he parties a little bit. And, you know, one night he takes too many pills of different sorts, one too many. And his roommate finds him non-responsive and calls an ambulance. And he ends up getting 5150 by his mom. And his choices at that point are to go in rehab or to go and stay with his grandmother on a farm in a fictional county called Wyandotte County in northern Lower Michigan. He ends up there with a funky little job for the Land Conservancy and stumbles across a dead body in the snow one day. Finds out that there's a reward, and he wants to get it so that he can go back to LA.
And I want to tell you, when he stumbled on the body, I was like, how, okay, I like amateur sleuths, and Marshall's good with them. How is, why is he going to care enough to investigate this? Because, you know, no, I understood why, what his motivations were, but I thought, why is Henry Melch going to, why does he care about this body? And he did a good job.
Thank you.
Once I read it, I'm like, oh, that's why he does it. So how is this different than book two? What's new in book two? That you can tell us.
I don't know what to say. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think. What can I say? I mean, he's still stuck there. He's still trying to get home. He is still taking pills that he should not be. He's slowly, gradually learning things about himself and still trying to figure out how to get out of there.
I got to tell you one thing I noticed. This may be putting you on the spot a bit. when you did the Boys Town series, you could tell you have a fondness for Boys Town. And the same thing with the Pink's video series, talking about Silver Lake. I tell people I grew up in North Carolina, but actually until the age of 10, I lived in Michigan. This story takes place up north where I lived in Western Michigan. I lived in the extreme Southwest. However, you did a really good job describing Michigan. It took me home.
Oh, thank you.
That being said, it wasn't as shown in as good a light as the other stories.
Oh.
Is that a reflection of your interpretation of where you're living now?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, he's a 24-year-old kid, and I don't really know that I'd want to be a 24-year-old gay kid here. That makes it more problematic. You know, where I live, it's a purple county, you know, which means that I meet a lot of people who are very liberal and very cool and who I enjoy quite a lot. And then, you know, I meet a lot of people that I don't really want to finish the conversation with, who are challenging and difficult. So, you know, it's a little different, you know, not that, you know, in LA, you know, yeah, you're going to meet some people who are conservative and dickwads about it, but it happens more frequently up here, I think. And, you know, and it happens in a way that's different. You know, you can be walking in the grocery store and somebody starts talking about how horrible Hillary Clinton is and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, honestly, I don't know where I'd live in the world if I had tons of money. I'd really kind of gotten to the place where I'm here. It's affordable. There's a lot to like about it. So I'm focused on a personal basis, I'm focused on what I like about it, what I enjoy about it, the people I enjoy here. You know, I'm doing what's in front of me. You know, which is not, you know, Henry is, you know, I mean, he's not someone who's that mature, so he's not really thinking in those terms.
Ocracoke Island is in North Carolina, and I love the island. And when I was in my early 20s, I almost bought a restaurant there because I loved it so much. And now I look back and I'm like, it's a village of maybe 700 people, and K through 12 is one small building. What would a 20-year-old gay man be doing there? Like, in a year, I would have been going crazy. So, yeah, I can see why Northern Michigan would not be the best of places for a young gay man. Since you're there, I know you grew up when you were younger in Northern New York. Mm-hmm. And you've lived in various parts of the country, and now you're in Michigan and you're actually having a house built. Where would you say home is?
That's an interesting question. I mean, home is, you know, where my stuff is, where I am, where my dog is, where I have friends. You know, those things are very important. I mean, I've been kind of floating around in people's guest houses for several years, and I'm very much looking forward to getting my stuff out of storage and being in a home that is completely mine. You're reminding me, though, that, you know, people ask me, do I miss LA? Do I miss Chicago? And it's like, I've started to answer them in a different way. I miss LA in the 90s. I miss Chicago in the 80s. And, you know, that is one of the things that I love about what I do is that I can visit. And I know if I went to LA tomorrow, if I went to Long Beach tomorrow, there's certain things that I would enjoy, but then I'd also be standing around going, this place is no longer familiar. You know, I've been gone for 6 years and it's like, this is not the same place. You know, it's like the places that I lived, that I enjoyed when I was there are gone. So.
Do you in any sense feel like you don't have a place?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that on and off in the last few years, but I'm looking forward to having my own home again, definitely. Definitely. So, I mean, I try to do what's in front of me, so I don't really dwell any more than I have to on what's, you know, not working. I just try to make it work.
So I want to get back to Henry Milch.
Okay.
Because one thing I found interesting is I hear a lot of advice given to new writers. That advice is don't make pop references because then your book becomes dated.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, some people would call me a nostalgia writer because I do specifically write about periods of time. And, you know, you have to put those references in to make the reader feel that that's where they are. It becomes as important as a setting, important as character. I would say that, you know, part of the reason that books date is because they're not specifically set in time. I mean, in a way, my books don't really date because they begin that way. You know, so the first Boys Town books are always going to be set in 1981. You know, and so the coming to them, when I published them, and so I started publishing them in 2009, it's the same experience now as it was then. Whereas even amongst my own books, you know, I really enjoyed writing Fathers of the Bride. I did not set that in time. It's sort of in a non-COVID world. It's a contemporary non-COVID world. And I know in 10 years, it's going to be a little awkward to read that book, you know, because you're going to be wondering things like, like, when is this happening? Where is this? What is going on? You know? So in some respects, I think actually setting your book in time is wiser. Although I once got in trouble with a reader because I've written about sidetracks in Chicago several times and I didn't happen to remember where a particular beer cooler was. And I got busted for that. You know, one thing I've learned is that in writing about places that I've been, over time, it's like I look back and it's like, okay, I should have spent a lot more time there and a lot more time there. Because it's like, oh, you know, I mean, I think I went to sidetracks twice, you know. So I should have invested more in my future by spending more time in bars.
I guess. So this could be a little bit about me, but it's because I'm rolling up to you. In my first book, Mitch has a love interest and is very, very, very slow burn, very slow burn. And people latched onto it much more than I thought they would. In the second book, I'll just say there was trouble. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I don't try to read my reviews, but I did read one in Goodreads. And somebody was very disappointed that the relationship was going sour and they were worried it was not going to continue. And the comment they made is, and I'm not going to name the books because I don't want to give any spoilers away. They said, I hope Brad is not doing the same thing that Marshall Thornton did in blank or Jeffrey Round did in blank so the protagonist can work through other love interests and make it interesting. What do you have to say about that? To me, they're saying I should write to market.
Yes. But even writing to market can lead you astray. And you need to write what works for the character and what works for how you feel about relationships. And I mean, I've done a lot of different things in 30 books. So I don't always want to do the same thing as well. So I mean, I know that there are people out there who didn't like Nick because he's sort of promiscuous in the 80s, but that, you know, that turned out to be... When I started out in 2009, I was working with a publisher who published romance and erotica, and I wasn't really interested in writing romance, so I put a lot of sex in those first books. Mm-hmm. And then I do read my reviews and I do listen to what people have to say. And, you know, I saw that, you know, it wasn't really being enjoyed. And so I began to kind of tone down what I was doing, which, you know, for the Boys Town books, I thought worked really quite well because of the AIDS crisis and the way that that played out in the books time-wise. And eventually, you know, the last Boys Town books doesn't have any sex at all, and I actually didn't see a lot of complaints about that. So, and that said, I mean, some of the sex I thought was very important, and sometimes sex is very important to a book. So if you are writing about something where it is the point, that's great. And certainly, you know, one of the things I've learned about readers is that they want to read the same thing again and again, except they want it to be different. Mm-hmm. And so when the thing that you bring to it that's different is part of what they really wanted, you know, then they're disappointed. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of books out there which are really more romance first and mystery second. If people are looking for that, they're not going to be very happy with what I do.
Well, and I feel the same way. And I really don't know where I'm taking that. I haven't made the decision. But I will tell you that I'm feeling this pull that I should write to market, which means people want to see them together and have a happily ever after. And I read you wrote something that I've said on this show many times. In mysteries, the happily ever after is, you know, justice served at the end, one way or another. But that's not what it means to everybody.
Right.
So I'm getting this pull, and I don't know where I'm going to go with it yet. But I'm in a roundabout way, I'm asking this. There are Facebook groups that I'm sure you're familiar with that are specifically dedicated on how to, let's say, get rich writing books. Mm-hmm. And what they teach people is research what the market is right now. So, okay, this month, Schaefer romance novels are really popular. Quickly get out of Schaefer romance novel. Oh, you know what? Next month, bisexual adventures are really popular. Write a bisexual adventure. Could you write like that?
No, I think it's ultimately a bad time, a bad idea. Sorry. And I think the times that I've come close to doing that or trying to do that did not work out for me. The things that have worked out best for me are, you know, when I do the thing that's unique to me, you know, when I have a clear idea and understand why I want to write it, what it matters to me along the way. One of the things I realized is, you know, I have done blogging here and there, and which is basically bitching in public. Mm-hmm. And I've run across issues and thought, oh, you know, that really bugs me. I want to blog about that. And when I wrote my book, Femme, that's actually where that came from, is that I thought, oh, I should write a blog about how feminine men are treated in the gay community. And then I thought, don't do that. Write a book. And so eventually I wrote that book. As a response to something I saw. And so, you know, and it wasn't that exactly personal experience, but it's, you know, something that I was really interested in and was bugged by, you know. So if something's bugging you, actually, it's better to put it into a book than it is to put it into a blog, because you can examine it more and spend less time arguing with people online.
And Femme got a lot of really good recognition, I should add.
It did very well.
Gregory Ashe and C.S. Poe both write books that are about, I consider them almost 50-50 romance mystery. They are probably the dividing line. I wouldn't go any beyond that. And I was talking to Greg one day on the phone, and I brought up, I said, you know, you're smarter than me. How did you do this? And Greg said, I just wrote what I wanted. I can't write romance because I'm not that interested in romance.
Mm-hmm. So you're not a romance reader?
A little bit of romance, and I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy it. I'm trying to think of the one that you wrote that you had me read. Oh, my goodness. It's a recent one. Code.
Oh,
Codename Liberty. Now, that was mostly romance. It wasn't entirely just romance. And I enjoyed that. But as a rule, it's not. I'm not going to go to the bookshelf and grab a romance. My husband will, but I'm not.
One of the things that I talk about, we'll talk to new writers and I'll talk to old writers who are working. And, you know, then this issue comes up a lot of, you know, what should I write? How do I become successful? And the thing is, it's a Venn diagram. You know, you have to find the intersection of the thing that's in your heart and the market. So most writers have a lot of ideas, and I just encourage people to find that sweet spot. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I really enjoy writing genre fiction as opposed to literary fiction is that I get to write about anything I want to as long as I put it into a structure, you know, the structure of a mystery or the structure of a romantic comedy, you know, and then you can write anything. It's a particular path to write literary fiction, and that's really something you can only do through major publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Finding that path is very difficult, and so genre just allows you a lot of freedom that is hard to find elsewhere. We've strayed from your question.
I actually had a response, and I don't remember what it was, but we'll move on. I want to touch on something controversial that came up, I think it was 2 years ago. That was Lambda Literary decided to combine, they used to have lesbian mystery and gay mystery, and they've combined them together. I don't know what it's called. Is it LGBTQ mystery or queer mystery? I don't know. But they combined them together.
Mm-hmm.
And you chose to write a public letter stating why you weren't happy with this and said you would no longer be submitting books to Lambda Literary, which is quite astounding for somebody that has been recognized so much as you have. Care to talk about that?
Sure.
What upset you?
I did actually submit this year. Okay, well, let me explain. The problem I saw was that, you know, they said that they were being more inclusive, which I disagree with because they actually reduced the number of awards. Their top categories have awards that are specific to trans people and specific to bisexual people or grouped for them. And consequently, there are more awards in poetry, for example, and more awards in nonfiction for all these different groups. And by collapsing the genre categories, they're basically saying they're not important. They're not as important as the other awards. And the thing is, you know, if you really sit down and think about it, the literary fiction awards, the poetry award, those are, you know, the nonfiction, those are the books that come from big publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little self-publishing at that level. And so, of course, they're not collapsing those. So I found it very problematic. I also find it very difficult in the sense that I've been entering that contest for like 10 years and I've thought a lot about how books are judged. And, you know, it is a very subjective process. And for a category like gay mystery, you can decide to award books because of a career, or you can decide to award on the basis of which book is a better mystery, or you can set the criteria as being how literary is the book, or the criteria can be is how gay is the book. So there's a lot of different ways to look at just simply gay mystery. And then you throw in different sexualities and different gender expressions and have them compete with each other. You know, then you have to sit down with a scorecard and, you know, after 5 years, you have to say, oh, well, you know, nobody bisexual has ever won since the category has been collapsed. And so now we really need to give it to someone who's bisexual or who's written a bisexual book. And, you know, that's just really skews the whole thing. So anyway, I have a problem with it. I do have to say, this year I entered my book, Fathers of the Bride, into the gay romance category,
mm-hmm.
which still exists. And I've heard that they tried to collapse that and the outcry was incredible. And so they didn't. So I don't know why it's acceptable to have separate categories there, but not elsewhere.
Well, I will say when you posted the letter, I agreed with you 100%. I'm a little swayed the other way now, but I will tell you what my big concern is more than anything. Everybody I know that has been a judge for Lambda Literary has said it is outrageously difficult to try and read all the books that are submitted. And sometimes you have to judge on a very small section of the book, whether you're going to continue or not.
Right.
So now I picture this, that pile has doubled for those folks. So I don't know how it can be done effectively.
One of the things that they did at the same time, which went relatively unnoticed, is that they stopped publishing the entries. You know, previous to that change, they would publish every book that had entered.
You're right.
So you could see that there were 30 or 40 gay mysteries in competition for the 8 slots. And now they don't show that anymore. So, I mean, I really have no idea how many books have been entered into the mystery category. If other people didn't stop, then there's like 70 books, 80 books.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it becomes less and less appealing to send them $65 a book to be considered amongst this crowd of books that are very dissimilar from yours.
And I hadn't even realized they did that. I know in the past, John Michelson, the author who created the Gay Fiction Mystery Suspense Thriller Group on Facebook, whenever someone would submit to Lambda Literary and it would be posted that they received their book, he would go, "Way to go, Marshall. Way to go, Brad." That didn't happen, and you're right. There was a reason. We didn't know who submitted. This is where I spin the wheel and randomly get a question. They're questions that are, as I said, awkward or difficult to answer, or sometimes they're just downright rude. And I'm going to spin the wheel, and we're going to see what you get. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, Marshall. With you, I cheated. I did not choose a random question. I created one based on something I read. Just so the listeners know, every week now when I have a guest, I ask them to write a blog post. And you can go to the website, queerwritersofcrime.com, and there's a place that says guest blog. And Marshall submitted one that actually is very interesting. It's a good post. Thank you, Marshall. Sure. And the title of it is How to Read a Mystery. And I'm going to ask you a question from that, because you talk about all the different mysteries categories that are out there. You talk about the puzzles, the suspenseful, the mysteries, the cozy mysteries, police procedurals, PI, amateur sleuth, etc. If you are going to go to the store, to the library, and pick out a mystery, and I'm sure you probably read all the above, which one of those are you most likely to go for?
I go through periods. I do like procedurals. Several of the series that I follow are procedurals, but I also do like cozies. I've read several series with women protagonists that I enjoy quite a lot. But then conversely, I really like Michael Connelly's Bosch books, which are nothing like a cozy or a female protagonist. So I do really enjoy series. I will always choose a series over a standalone, because I'd like the long-term development of the characters.
I'm with you there. I much more enjoy a series than a standalone. You made me think of something that I've always thought. Pink's Video, you call a cozy series. It's kind of on the fringe, though. I don't know. There's a lot of people that would say that is not a cozy.
Oh, yeah.
And I question it. I love the books. Under what definition do you consider that a cozy?
Well, you know, cozies feature an amateur investigative character, as I call them, and he's definitely an amateur. Mm-hmm. Normally, I think one of the variances is that, you know, cozies are supposed to take place in a village. And I think for me, Silver Lake kind of stands in for that. It's in L.A., and certainly I do use all of L.A. when I write the books, but it's in a particular part, you know, it's in a particular social group. Books take place amongst queer people, you know, in Silver Lake, mainly, you know, largely gay men. And so that's a smaller group. So it's like, it is a sort of village to me. definitely, you know, they're not supposed to have a lot of violence, and I do violate that a little bit here and there. And, you know, they're supposed to not have a lot of swearing, which, you know, kind of fudged that one a little bit too. So, but he does keep tripping over bodies, which is a very cozy thing to do.
That's what I love about amateur sleuths.
Yes. And I like, and I enjoy making fun of that. You know, because they talk about it. I do know that the next book, which I'm going to write in the fall, it's going to be called Help Wanted. And it will start out with him talking about how, thank God, he's not seen a dead body in 6 months.
That's awesome. Well, Marshall, it is a pleasure to have you back on. I want you to give the name of your book again, the latest book.
A Fabulously Unfabulous Summer for Henry Milch.
And you folks, as always, it's no surprise, I will have a link in the show notes to purchase the book. And it's a pleasure to have you back. I think this is the third time you've been on. In fact, I'm sure it is. Very few people have been on three times. Welcome back. We'll have to have you on again.
Okay.